Well, good evening and welcome to the final presentation in this, our 15th season of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with help from our webmaster, Wanda Gillette, taking pictures, Pai Wan Wan, our facility specialist in the back, Daniel Peach. Katie Reeder and Chris DeMayo designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shatton Melke. Our speaker tonight was born in Baytown, Texas, and grew up in Paducah, Kentucky, where he attended schools. He received his BA in studio art from Murray State University, and his first live professional performance took place at the Eddyville State Penitentiary as a harmonica player as part of a Neo Vaudeville act at the age of 16, and it ended in a near riot. While at Murray, he formed the legendary Shack Shakers, a Southern Gothic rock and blues band in the mid-1990s, which toured widely with the likes of Robert Plant, the Black Keys, and Hank Williams III. His discography includes 17 albums. He's been nominated for a Grammy, and his music has been featured on HBO's True Blood series. In 2015, he was featured on the BBC original series Songs of the South in an episode focusing on the musical history of Tennessee and Kentucky. He's directed a film, and he's an accomplished visual artist. In his first solo album, Fire Dream, recorded at Delta Sonic Sound in Memphis this February, he creates a complex tapestry of styles and sounds, playing banjo, harmonica, and piano. In his first book, Barn Dances and Jamborees Across Kentucky, published in 2013, and he tells us continuously updated, he writes, as a professional harmonica player and a singer in a hillbilly music group, I've played my share of festivals and nightclubs since the age of 16. You name it, I've played it. His debut novel, The Vine That Ate the South, published in 2017 by $2 Radio Press, to quote the publisher, is a mesmerizing fantasia that incorporates vampire cults, exorcisms, and the Bell Witch of Tennessee. It follows the journey of two young men through a haunted forest in the forgotten corner of western Kentucky. Please welcome the multi-talented J.D. Wills.
How y'all doing?
Good.
Well, he already said everything I was going to say. Brag on myself. Basically, there's a lot of things you just described that I've done, but it all is one thing, and it is hold dear what others discard, basically. I like cultural things that I remember as a child, my grandparents telling me about, or riding around in the truck with them out in the woods and hearing stories. It's basically nostalgia, I'll admit. But it's also our culture, and it's in danger, I think, because of cell phones and pop culture and technology, and I just don't want to lose it all right away. So I hold dear what others have discarded because of nostalgia and sentiment. That has to do with music, and it has to do with storytelling, and that's what the two books over here are about. This one, Barn Dances and Jamborees Across Kentucky, is about holding dear to our musical traditions, because we have a culture here in this state and in this area, and within the various regions and hollers of our one state. There's so many different traditions within that as you go into the micro. That's another thing I'd like to talk about with both books, is that this isn't a Southern culture thing. It is a culture thing. It can be as macro and micro as you want to take it. And the further you peel back those layers of the onion, you'll see so many different things. And that's why I encourage everyone to do their genealogies, to interview their grandparents, to do these sorts of things, because it's interesting and you end up getting a lot out of it then, and no one else is going to do it here for you. So this is one of the things that I was left with when I became a rock and roller and was touring around the world and doing all this wild stuff. I just kind of come home. I was missing home. I was homesick. And I would wax poetic there in Europe or wherever I was, describing things about what I missed about home. And so I ended up doing that twice. The musical book, this Barn Dances and Jamborees Across Kentucky, I ended up deciding that when I did get home, I was going to take a road trip from one end of Kentucky to the other, and I was just going to try to find all the little nooks and crannies and all the little hollers, all those little community get-togethers where people play music for the right reasons instead of trying to make money. And it was, you know, basically like those old jamborees. Maybe you've been to some before. This one here, Renfro Valley Barn Dance, has been going on for a long time. There's an upset here recently. It's been purchased and turned into something different, but it still does exist, and their gospel radio show still goes on, and I think it's the only thing competing with the Grand Ole Opry for as long, being on the air for as long. But this would be kind of the granddaddy of them all, and these kinds of these get-togethers. This would be technically in a barn, but it's basically when you go inside, it's an amphitheater. So this was one of the places I went to that, you know, that it kind of splits the difference between the business end of things and the old-timey historical barn dance. It's not quite the barn dance I was looking for. I'm looking for an actual barn. You know, this is another amphitheater. I found, we can't do that. I have to clean up my thing here. I was looking for a real barn, and I found it in Rosine. And, where's the Rosine guy? You know about the Rosine Barn Dance, right? Yeah. Take pictures there. This, tell them it's a real barn. It's basically unswept, and it's been there. It's basically where Bill Monroe invented bluegrass music. And there I am standing out there. Tell I'm in hog heaven, because there's this bluegrass music going everywhere, and everyone there looks like they come out of a movie. They got Christmas lights hanging up in there, and they're selling cassette tapes of the band, cassette tapes for $2 out of the shoebox. Right across, like where I'm looking, right across the street to the railroad was a old railroad shack where Bill Monroe basically came up with the idea for bluegrass music. He would consult to this wandering gadabout, Arnie Schultz, African American up from New Orleans, who was taught himself how to play barrel house piano music on a six string guitar. And that basically, if it hadn't been for Arnie Schultz conveying that information to Bill Monroe, and also conveying the information to Merle Travis, we wouldn't have two of our most prominent Kentucky born offshoots of country music, which is bluegrass music and Travis picking. One was born out of Ohio County and one in the neighboring Muhlenberg County. So draw the roots back to that one guy that came up with that idea to play piano music on the guitar, to get the articulation that you hear in bluegrass and in Travis picking. That's all Bill Monroe got this, received that information right across from where I'm looking right there. When you go in there, and people might be from Denmark, they might be from Spain, you know, they welcome everybody there at the Rosine Barn Jamboree. That's exactly what I was looking for. And basically getting back to basics, getting back to community. Scotty Henson just passed away yesterday, but he's the one who taught me how to play banjo. I went there for a bluegrass banjo lesson, but his hand had... you can kind of see it frozen up due to a stroke into the perfect claw hammer. So I ended up getting a claw hammer banjo lesson from him. But he had taught many of the wunderkinds from Western Kentucky, Josh Williams and Chris Thiele, who now he took over for Garrison Keillor, Lake Wobegon. What was that? Prairie Home Companion. Well, he's a student of Scotty's too, and he gives these lessons out in his little cabin there. And again, this is what I'm talking about. Back to basics, community, and like homespun humor, things that you can't download, things that you can't find online. We talked talking about social media. That's, you know, I'm talking about actual socializing with people and learning how to talk to folks and learning the music, not from YouTube, but from guys like Scotty. So that set me on a quest. Stanley Walker is another one. Stanley's over here. He's from Western Kentucky. The little guy there. He still plays. And he basically is a veteran of Sun Studios, Sun Records out of Memphis, and also the Grand Ole Opry. He was there whenever Rock and Ray Smith had his big hit, and then he ended up being supporting guitarist and music director for Gene Shepherd on the Grand Ole Opry, and he's still playing in Western Kentucky. This is a generation that I sort of look up to because they were there in the Depression. They were there at times before there were such things as supermarkets. Charlie Stamper here also passed away last year. I remember seeing his first automobile having to be pulled out of them. Not just like the first automobile of Knott County, but having to be pulled out of the mud by a mule. His first banjo was made out of a log that his grandpa or his dad made, you know, cross cut of a log. Basically grew up learning firsthand all those old tunes that probably some of them date back to the 1600s, you know, but he's learning them firsthand, not off of YouTube. That's the type of person I want to get to know, because this is a thing I'm craving, because as a Gen Xer, I've been cut off from those sorts of things growing up with television and cable TV and now the internet. So it's like, can I get back to what it is to be human? And the only way that I know how to do that is to befriend the elderly. But these folks are dying, you know, all the time, dropping dead. But they kind of got to meet him. And before he passed away, thank you very much. I got a cold, sorry, y'all. We were able to, like, tick off one of the things on his bucket list, which was to record before he passed away. His younger brother, Art Stamper, is in the Bluegrass Hall of Fame. His father was recorded by the Smithsonian, yet he chose a normal life, getting married and having children, but it's arguable that he was the superior fiddle player. His log cabin where he was born, it's on the National Registry of Historic Places, yet no one knows who Charlie Stamper is. So I made sure that we tried to write that. We got a hold of Apple Shop, and we put out a record, and then we also put out another record. We got for sale over here I just took my phone and put on record on the Memo app, and we just played around the phone. Sounding great, because if you think about Alan Lomax, he was going around recording people like 70 years ago with like a wire and a reel-to-reel, and then but just the Memo app on our phone is such superior technology to what he was recording with back then, doing those field recordings. It ended up kind of sounding exactly how it needed to, especially once it hit vinyl. So Charlie put out these two records, and then he passed away. And so it's one of the things I like to do is not just write about it, but it's also to record and just to get down to all posterity, because it isn't about money for me. It's about, it's about making a mark before Homo sapiens goes the way of the Matrix. Let's see, where are we at? The world passed away. All these guys are dead. This is like a year ago. I did this thumb drive a year ago. When I put it in, they were all alive. The last presentation I did, they were all alive. It's really weird to do a presentation now and to know they're all dead. It's very strange for me. Earl was this guy was a hoot. He made up his own going, little honky tonk, out in the woods of Marshall County. Wasn't that good at building the thing, but he got it done. He poured the concrete down the hill without any leveling or frames or forms to make a foundation. He just poured it and built on top of that. So when you went in to his honky tonk, it was like this.
Like a fun house.
But it was awesome, and it was real, and it was what I was looking for. And he sounded like Ernest Tubb, and he had no one in there was under the age of 80. So I'm in hog heaven. I don't trust anyone under 80 anyway. But, so this is the kind of music I like, you know. I like the stuff that's the opposite of what you'll hear on country music radio now. Because I hold dear what others discard, and the way of country music is not incorrect. It is going the way of the corporate cause and effect of society as things just get more corporate and sophisticated and savvy. That's just how things go. And so the music is going to reflect that. When you've got GPS in your combines, and it can drive itself. Your tractor can drive itself. And then then you're not going to have country music sound the same either. Because it's all part and parcel to the cause and effect of our universe and how it evolves. But I'm just sentimental. My grandparents were antique dealers. I was raised around a lot of antiques and old things, and everything had a patina on it. And that's just how I like my life. And I don't like it all fancy. Fonzie Davis. This was like, barn dances are also a radio thing that happened right around 1927, as radio technology came in and people were going up into urban environments up north, leaving behind the old agraria. The technology met up with working circumstances of the time, the late 20s, and it created this phenomenon, this nostalgia boom, basically, is what happened. Country music was born out of nostalgia to begin with.
Pardon me. 1927
is when more people were officially employed by the system than were homesteading their own farms. So you definitely had the true death of agrarianism died. It was in 1927. So as they all go moving up north into the factories, they start to miss the ways that they grew up. So in comes radio as a technology, and in comes these country music musicians there to provide for the nostalgic displaced hillbillies, say in Detroit or Chicago, this type of music. And that's how the country music industry got off it in the first place. So we don't have a nostalgia market anymore. We have a future lust that's being reflected in country music now. And that's why I have no use for it. But this is the kind of stuff that for the longest time, right up into the 70s, and in the last gasp of the 90s, I think it was still kind of a hip. It's a true hillbilly music. Oh, thank you. Well, I don't know what's going on here.
That's clean.
I wasn't
going to
take an antihistamine and fall asleep on you either. So.
Post-nasal drip.
Let's see. All right, now let's get into this other book here. All right, Vine That Ate the Sow. That's the folk tale version, the ghost story folk tale version of the very thing I was just talking about. So, you got your music, and then you also have your oral tradition of storytelling. And so I drew this this cover. We had several different covers going on. I would have never thought to put this on the cover, but the publisher thought that yellow was pretty hip that year, and it makes for a great thumbnail on the computer screen, and actually we did pretty good with pre-sale, so maybe he was right and I was wrong. Pink and yellow, who knew? and a screaming wampus cap. Anyone ever heard of a wampus cap? Basically like panthers or whatever you hear that run around. I've actually seen those, the big cats that run around in the woods. I thought they were the stuff of legend. My brother-in-law caught a captured one on his like deer stand camera that's like a motion sensor thing. He printed it out and it was a Black Panther in Livingston County, Kentucky. And I was like, well, maybe it's like an actual small cat, but it's close to the camera or something, but I didn't know if it was real or not. Then I heard one roar at night. It was like a cat in heat mixed with a roar. And there's so much echo coming off of it. It was like, I knew it had to be about that far. It had to be like a half a mile away from the creek where I live. And then every dog in a mile radius started barking. So they heard it too. So I was like, well, maybe he was right. Maybe there is such a thing as a wampus cat. And then as I was going to Earl's Jamboree, the guy that sounds like Ernest Tubb, was driving out there one day. And I saw what looked like a mountain lion running across the street. And times, as I'm driving, time slowed down. It's like in shock in a way. It's like, it's not a dog. It's like a golden retriever, but it's not. So it's like it was about this big of a cat and running like a cat does when they run real fast. And I was like, wow, they are real. It was out in the woods in Marshall County. So they wampus cats, and it's no longer, it's kind of been debunked as a being a myth. It is a true thing, and I've seen it with my own eyes, and they're starting to find them now, these big cats. Okay, now I'm all messed up here. I don't know how this works. All right, so we're going to do... I wrote the book originally because I was homesick, just like the other one. I wrote them both because I was homesick. I was in the mountains of Norway, literally in the mountains, because the highway goes through these caves, these tunnels, and you're plunged into darkness for like 30 minutes at a time. And really, I opened up my laptop first just as a light source, just to have some light. We're in the Arctic Circle. I mean, it's really like, and even if you were outside of the cave, it would still be dark because it's really strange territory up there. So I was just kind of going nuts from not seeing light. I didn't see light. So I opened up my laptop and there's light finally. And then I started waxing poetic about home. When I wrote this book, it took me a couple of years to get it kind of in shape. And then like a novel. Basically novelizing all the old folk tales and ghost stories I heard growing up, mixing it in with dreams, mixing it in with nostalgia and horror and humor, all the things that I like to write songs about, all the things I'd like to read. What would I want to read? I wrote a book that I would like to read, and I kept myself company while I was on tour by playing in my head since it was so dark out. So I wrote it, and then it was like, okay, well, maybe someone would want to publish it. I don't know. So it's like about a year of rejections. And then I uploaded it to some service where it just sends it out for you. So it's like, well, I guess I'll just either box it up and slide it under the bed and just say, hey, I wrote a novel, I guess. That's good enough, I guess. Or I thought maybe I could turn it into a graphic novel, since a lot of my connections are to cartooning comics. It's like a sideline of mine anyway, so I started drawing. And so what the plot is about, and you can see here, the overall plot is about, starts off with like a legend about these old folks that die in their woodland home there in Kentucky. They die around the same time, like old folks do. And then Cudson gets into the house. See, there they are, dead in bed up there, and it starts curling around everything. And eventually, wraps around the bodies. It gets so lush and takes over everything so bad that it pulls the bodies out of the window and weaves them into the trees, crochets them into the wilderness, is the way I put it. And I'll just read this. Days passed into weeks, and then months. Soon it became... It began resembling the digesting rat lumps of a boa constrictor. It bloated and bloated with rich human nutrients and could not be contained. The rate of its growth doubled, then tripled, it pulled itself ever more through the floorboards like a giant thread unraveling from the very fabric of nature. At last it burst through the walls and overtook the entire Kentucky clifftop, plus anything else in sight. Since the shut-ins had no family to remove what was left of the bodies, the plant reserved the honors for itself. And in the same way an acorn can fall to earth and spring to a mighty life of its own, in the same way roots exhume the coffins they so rudely invade, this humble weed defied expectation. It gathered the lovers up, pulled them through the window, and crocheted them into the wilderness. To this day, it's all there for anyone to see, a horrible hillbilly filigree of dangling belongings and shocking remains. All of it cocooned in the oaks upon high. Yes, for decades, these souls just hung there, caught in a gauzy blur between heaven and earth. Robes of flesh fell away. A new circulatory system twisted through their bones. It is said that the husband in particular suspends crowned with the graying laurels of past winters. His jaw hangs like a swinging crescent. His rib cage houses a nest of squirrels, and his skull eyes are the doors of a Martin Gourd. But as well known as the old couple is down here, it's hard to believe that few have actually laid eyes on them. So that's why they're going into the woods, is to find this dark prize. Character and his buddy, and they go carving a trail to find this house. So that was the idea. And along the way, there's all these ghost things and there are these ghost stories that come to life. I'm novelizing all the folk tales that I heard growing up and mixing in dreams. That's the fun that I had in writing this. And then it wasn't so fun because I wasn't getting any bites back, and I already started on this and still nothing. And finally got an email saying, hey, we love this book. And it was $2 radio and they wanted to publish it. I said, oh, cool. Well, I was about to throw it away anyway and put it back under the bed and say, no. And then they helped me edit it. And, we went back and forth. That was about another year of itself. And I said, yeah. And we were joking one day. I said, yeah, I was about to give up on it. And I was turning it into a graphic novel, drawing pictures for it. And said, oh, really? Are you a drawer? You illustrate? I said, yeah. Can we see the drawings? I said, yeah. So I sent them the pictures that I had drawn. Pull up some of this. Let's put them in the book. And I said, oh, that's cool. Wasn't there kind of kids? And he's like, why don't you just illustrate kids' books? And he told me about some other books for adults. And then it was like, well, yeah, that's fun. I would like to do that anyway. So that ended up being what we did. An illustrated novel for grown-ups. But it's also, and then I put a little map in the front there, like a kind of a Lord of the Rings thing. And we were joking earlier about how, like, fact-checking a book like mine is kind of you can't do it because it's a lot of it is sort of the Middle Earth version of Kentucky. That kind of like bizarro world Kentucky. So it's like, the geography is already all messed up on this thing. It doesn't exist this way. There aren't like hurricanes that just hang out, little tornadoes that hang out. And obviously it's a dreamscape. And so, go easy on me when you go fact-checking this thing. it's full of hogwash anyway. But they start off up here, and I don't know if I want to give it away. There's some spoilers if I do, but should I read or what should I do?
Yeah, feel free.
Yeah.
Has anyone read this yet? Any section you want to hear from? Should I just do this?
Yeah.
It's the one I always do. Thank you for that. See.
could do the one about the hurricanes, the hurricanes. Which, by the way, I was going to tell you is a reference, as a sort of a shout out to William Gay, who talks about the hurricanes as his haunt. The name of his haunted woods in one of his stories was just called the hurricanes. And he's one of my favorite writers, William Gay. Windstorms from the south. Stickers snag our britches while we bounce our bicycles down the rock steps.
You can see here. So they're coming through here. This is where they're coming. So it's about midway through our journey.
A clearing blooms through the trees as the light of day returns. Here it is. Ah, relief from the forest. A craggy white canyon gapes wide at the sky like the jaws of a screaming planet. From atop its teeth, we survey the vast sweep of an alabaster quarry below. It is where, with a little luck and athleticism, we'll soon touch ground. A mirage ripples the horizon like the waves of an ocean, but a panasonic rumble warns of storms. The high prow of a frontline hulks heavy, flashing a mute coat of amber from a hidden filament. Heat lightning and the flicker of a dying sun. Although the sun's copper coin is unredeemed, beams of the eclipse lend its nimbus around the massive cloud bank and elongated trapezoidal rays. They are cartoonish rays, even, like the trademark label of an old orange crate, or the bars that shoot out from behind the head of a fearless leader, smiling down upon the moaning scythes of the proletariat. Stupid, childish bands of life, as if drawn in magic marker by the infant son of God. So tack it up on the fridge with a magnet. Nice job, kid, says the Lord. That's just what you say. It's been a-looking like rain since dawn. Thunder before 7, rain before 11. Whoa, ho, ho, take a look out there, I point with my eyes. 3 white dust devils descend from the black sky like tentacles in an ink cloud. Yep, that's typical. These hurricanes come a-blowing up from Realfoot Lake every summer, Carver says with a smile. We time it outright. He thinks we could launch ourselves off the ramp and into their grip to catch some air. The thrill ride of a lifetime. Let's go for it, Carver shouts, slapping my back like a gym coach. But he goes first, mounting up at the edge of a 200-foot ramp, pausing for breath and scanning the landscape to make some last-minute calculations. Carver reels back, adjusts his crotch, and then hurls himself down the rocky way at full speed. Fists hold fast while arms absorb a jackhammering motion. A small avalanche of gravel follows behind him. Dead ahead, a twister waits in lithe undulation, its slow dance making all the movement of a hypnotic hoodoo woman. Carver barrels forth like a little juggernaut, pedaling down onto the ramp, up the incline, off the lip, through the wind, and into the tornado's whisking column. It is perfectly timed as the storm's arms pull him inside, deep into the central eye. An extra 15-foot draws him heavenward. It torques him like a propeller blade for 3 full 360-degree rotations. Then, like a kite that's lost its zephyr, he plummets to the ground and power slides a swoosh into the gravel. Woo-hoo! He triumphs with a rebel yell. Die, Dimp, die. Your turn, rude hogger, dies. It's a tough act to follow, but hell, I'm a little drunk. I ponder the distance, guesstimating the moment my dust devil will pass. I turn full attention away from my many years of self-doubt and give over to a merciless force, one of lost southern enterprise and kudzu hunger. I stomp the rat traps and off I go down the mountainside at top speed, head down in hell for leather. My brain dedicates itself to navigating each pit, pebble, and crag, maintaining complete balance and control. My mind's eye, however, follows behind as if outside my body, looking down and out ahead of me. I hit the lip of the concrete ramp and suddenly I'm aloft to find a twister all my own. Lord have mercy! Hard mountain winds lift me in a speckled haze of stinging sand. I am weightless and alive. I can make out Carver's cheering in the background as my body and soul rise within the white windstorm. It is pure adrenaline as I reach the zenith and time stands still. Has anyone ever done this before? I wonder as my hat gets sucked into outer space. Peppering sand blasts my face and neck, and I'm spinning like a brat in a swivel chair. The tornado has wholly consumed me. Then down I drop, down towards the quarry bottoms below, down, down, down. Deciding to go it alone, I throw my 10-speed aside and Geronimo my legs, running midair, awaiting impact. The bike hits first and bounces itself into a ditch, but I stick my landing, post-holding my feet into the creek mud with a wet, buckling crunch. I slowly gather my full posture, lift my head towards Carver, and punch two fists of victory into the wind. Yes! Pretty fam dancy! Carver hollers, you must have plumb gone up an extra 25 freaking feet. God dog, I shout, picking up my bike as the three dust devils dissipate against the cliff. That was insane. My heart was boxing my chest bones. My eyes are crying out sand, and I can tell that adrenaline is masking some pretty severe bruising. Did you get as sandblasted as I did, Carver asks, showing off some of his bloody abrasions. Black blood congeals around his pebbles stuck in his skin, spitting out a mist of grit. Red rivulets streaming down his cheeks. Yeah, I got popped pretty good, but you were right, it was worth it. After some attaboys, we're back on the loose. The familiar friend of the old spur line welcomes us back. And just like that, I'm sitting on top of the world, sober as a judge and in love with life. It's kind of true, actually. Because my dad said when he was a kid in the 50s, they were riding, going off this bank of, like gravel hill. I don't know, somewhere in Calvert City, and there were like these dust devils going by on a really windy day that you could see that was pulling some of the sand off of this pile. And so they went, what do you call it, ramped off this hill, and they actually caught wind, and it turned them for a little bit, and exactly like an extra little foot or two, but it wasn't a full 20 feet of lift. But it was it's based on his story of him catching a dust devil when he was a kid, so... So it's folk tales, ghost stories your mom and dad taught you, told you, grandparents taught you, might be hogwash, and dreams, anything that it takes to make something entertaining and interesting. I just tried to novelize those sorts of things into one story, whereas like if you go to your local interest section here, they might be just standalone stories in a book that you take one at a time. But in this way, I just wrote it all as one novel. So that's The Vine That Ate the South. These are the things I hold dear, old music and old stories. And if y'all got any questions, I'm happy to answer.
So what are some of the ghost stories that really got you as a kid?
Let's see. Yeah, there's one in Paducah called The Eyes of Lane Road. And my mom told me the story. It's right around the corner from my grandparents' house. And they have a creepy house. It's an old antebellum home. So to think that this is what was around the corner into the woods, kind of, it was basically in the 50s. It's always in the 50s. this guy was making, he's driving down Lane Road. He's like smooching on his girlfriend while he's driving. He wasn't paying attention. His car goes off the bridge. And he dies, or they die, or whatever. And so now they said, you go there at midnight on a full moon, and you look down, you could see his eyeballs float to the top of the water, and it stares you down, and you go crazy. And they said, the eyes of Lane Road are upon you. Old things like that. Yeah. So everybody's got those little stories, I assume, that been told in the middle.
Other questions? One of your famous stories we were talking about at dinner time, is your very first, we have a person who made many trips to Eddie's. So in her honor, let me tell your story.
This was going to be in the Barn Dance book.
Yeah, your first gig.
My first gig, ever. So 16 years old. I was learning to play harmonica, and I got picked at a talent contest. I did not win the talent contest, but I did get a gig out of it. Some guy said, you'd be perfect for my little song and dance troupe. They have like a vaudeville, like, hello, my baby, kind of one of those kind of like vaudeville troupes where they go around entertaining the campers. And like whenever they do costume changes, you can come out and play harmonica and cover that over. Still later, get ready to come back out, and then you come off stage and say, okay, so I'm a time killer. I'm just out there killing time, playing harmonica. So like, all right, we do a couple of campgrounds. We culminate at the Eddyville State Penitentiary, the Kentucky State Penitentiary in Eddyville, which is the maximum security. This is my first gig. And, okay, 16 years old, going in to play harmonica for some prisoners, okay. And there's the can-can dancers and the guys in the top hats, and this sounds, great idea. So we get in the van, and we go plunging into darkness underneath that, you go into the, you've got to imagine, it's a castle on the Cumberland. It's very, very old and creepy looking, very gothic, the black buildings coming down from the windows and the bars and everything, and it's turreted like a castle. It really is a castle. And you go underneath and you come back out and you're in the courtyard, and it's heavy security, and they come out and they have this little pavilion area, like a picnic area, and that's where we're going to put our show on. And so so they're doing their song and dance thing, and I'm waiting over to the side with my harmonica, waiting for my cue. All right, now it's time for them to go to the costume change, and I go out there, and it's like, I didn't freak out. I just started playing harmonica, but it's a mixed crowd of, like, I guess small-time criminals, racially about the same, black and white, all hanging out together. Security guards are there. I can see there's, like, the purple gang, the red gang up in the balconies. The tears, all marching, They can't be there for the show, but the small-time people can. And they're sitting on the picnic tables, and one guy's got a guitar, so I guess it's not too scary. So I'm like, all right, then I'll start playing. But then I'm like, unaccompanied harmonica music is kind of annoying, or just is awkward, because it's like, now what do I do? Choo-choo, are they ready with their costumes yet? Doing my old Kentucky home now. Come on, guys. And then, so I look up, and the black fella there with the guitar, I'd say, well, did you come up and play? See, they told me not to talk to anybody. So he comes up, and we start jamming. And then the Aryan Nation skinheads all stand up and walk off. And then all this. Yeah, well, look, the skinheads are looking. They started getting mad, and they all started to walk away. And so all the security guards were like, get them out, get those kids out of here, get the kids out of here. So they'd scoop me up, put us all back in our van, and they'll get the hell out of here. And oh man, what did I do? I was upset, and I can only assume what happened behind us as we were rolling out. And I was just trying to entertain, and Ebony and Ivory, So they drop me off, get out. I'm at Pizza Hut there in Draftonville. My dad's waiting, because before I can drive, I get in the car. He goes, well, how'd your first gig ever go? And I go, I got fired for almost starting a race war. And he goes, supper's about ready. Man. And it's been downhill from there ever since. Anyway.
Other questions?
So it took you several years to writing it, get it published. Does that scare you away from doing it again, or do you hope to maybe do it all?
Well, I'm writing on the next one. Actually a sequel to it. And with the publisher said that they will take a look at it, so that gives me hope. So, and I'm just doing it kind of in the same kind of hobbyist way, not putting a bunch of emphasis on it or hope into it, just doing it to entertain myself. It's like, as long as I do that, then there's no pressure.
No deadline.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's for fun.
Since you're a seems like there's a lot of good visual stuff and great characters. Do you imagine a film version of it, either animated or live action, or what would you like to see?
Who's that director? Is it Guillermo del Toro? You'd almost have to have someone like him. It's too much for TV. Yeah, it's just it's over the top. Yeah, but yeah, that would be wonderful.
Who's the director? Who's gonna play the pair?
Oh, I don't know. I'd hope that when they did the audiobook, the guy, he did a good job. He did a good job, but he did not get Carver's voice. He had Carver talking like this. And I almost heard him being more kind of like King of the Hill. And they kind of were like, damn it, Bobby. You know, that kind of soft kind of thing, you know, but he's tough, but he had more of a horse thing.
So, I mean, you're pretty well-versed in the lore of Kentucky, and we've got a really good folklore school here, and mm-hmm. one of the best in the country, actually. And I was curious if you know of any other good media that deals with... Because I know there's a lot of material that we have access to at the WKWD libraries that deals with folklore. Mm-hmm. But I think what's good about the work that you may do is making a bridge from nostalgia for people from my generation to access it. So mm-hmm. we've had shows like Justified, which portray like Harlan County and some of the criminal elements of it, but also deal with the fact it's set in the area, it's filmed in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. I was curious if you have any media that's set here or in Tennessee that you feel is pretty accurate or is a pretty good depiction mm-hmm. that's interesting to you.
Man, I don't know. There was that movie, Searching for the Wrong Eyed Jesus, the BBC did, and it was actually kind of got me upset because it was the British came over and thought they'd do a little thing about the South, and then but it ended up being like a scripted documentary, and there's like these like art damage Southern Gothic moments, like what's going on with this like vignette you're setting up here, and it's like I ended up back in the MySpace days, I got into a feud with the BBC. And you gummed it all up, and let me do it. You know, I'll do a better documentary with a camcorder and a battery pack. And they said, okay, put your money where your mouth. They actually got back to me and called me out online. I'm like, okay. And so they basically like called my bluff, and I had to go make a documentary now. But it is not as beautiful a documentary as that. I'd say my Seven Signs, if you want to look it up, I think is about as authentic as I know to make it. It's almost the video version of the book. But I try to be fair, and I try to not stage anything, but that's tough to do whenever you're... But I'm trying to think, it is worth checking out that other documentary, Searching for the Wrong Eyed Jesus, and to contrast the two.
Do you know any, like Southern Gothic novels, like, have done a good... There's a difference between, I think, like, depicting reality, like, in a documentary sense, and depicting, like, a cultural or a folklore landscape of an area. Like, you know, for example, what you're doing in your novel probably depicts a lot of, like, what the culture and folklore of Kentucky is like, as a dreamscape. So I'm trying to ask, like, if there's any works that you find that you've enjoyed about this region that have done something similar to your work, that's kind of what more I was trying to get at. Like, is there any novels or depictions of Kentucky or in this area that have depicted the landscape of of this area?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. There's one book about the Knight Riders that I really like a lot, On Bended Knee. That's a good one. But when I write about beauty, because I don't want it to all be dark, I want there to be beauty. I like reading 19th century writers, poets, even like the romantic poets, and try to create my own ode to Kentucky. I try to... capture that language, use that language to capture how I feel about the area, rather than, I like to reapply other people outside of the genre, outside of Kentucky, just as, like Moby Dick is my favorite book, like I love Melville, I love Edgar Allan Poe, I love H.P. Lovecraft. I love some modern writers too. Stephen King, Linda Barry, cartoonists. I just tend to like look at how they look at life and the freedoms they allow themselves. And rather than getting stuck in like kind of regional thing, or I would say you'd be stuck in it, but I like to kind of open my mind up and look at how they look at the world and try to like channel how they do that. You know, I don't know if that makes any sense. I think I write more from a stream of consciousness than I do from a sense of regionalism.
Other questions?
What in the world how did you ever have your first performance
at the prison?
Yeah.
It probably was the first time that had ever happened there and the last time it ever happened. It just so happened to be the first time I ever played a gig. Yeah.
Did somebody do it for you? Or
yeah, it was called
joined?
The Popularity Showboat. It was a sort of a neo vaudeville song and dance thing that was set up by the Marshall County Tourism Board, and they needed.
How old were you?
That was like 15 or 16. Yeah.
Oh.
And so they set it up to be like sort of a tourism thing to go around, and then they're like, they said, "Well, that'd be great for the prisoners." I don't know why that was ever agreed upon. No, that would be a terrible idea, actually. But yeah, no, it was just it lasted for one summer, and I think that might have been the last gig ever. And I think I did them in. You know.
Any other questions?